You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
As new facts emerge, people are entitled to take a different view, and there's nothing in Article 50 to stop them. I think the British people have the right to know this. They shouldn't be misled.
Lord Kerr there, the author of Article 50, displaying a touching faith in the idea that facts have had much to do with Brexit, including the fact that, as he points out, it can be stopped. My guests Andrew Tuck, Chiara Ramella and Henry Rhys Sheridan will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including US President Donald Trump's tour of Southeast Asia, a victory for New York graffitists, if not necessarily for common sense, and how should we judge the cover of a book? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Andrew Tuck, the editor of Monocle, Chiara Ramella, a writer with Monocle, and Monocle 24's Henry Rhys Sheridan. Welcome all. We will start tonight with the latest developments in Brexit, still being negotiated by those members of Her Majesty's government who haven't been compelled to resign in the last couple of weeks. Michel Barnier, the EU's chief negotiator, has said that the UK has 2 weeks to clarify its position vis-à-vis its anticipated divorce settlement, among other issues. Ireland's border, far from least among them. Given that the chances of this being sorted out appear on form negligible, might it be time to heed Lord Kerr, the drafter of Article 50, who says the exit process is reversible? Andrew, first of all, Kerr was speaking after the government announced that it wants to fix the precise moment of Brexit in law. This will be 2300 hours on March 29th, 2019. Why is the government doing that?
I think they just want to make clear that there is no going back, and they want to kind of tie it all up and make it assured. And you can understand they're in a slightly wobbly position at the moment, and they don't seem to be getting anywhere. And they want to make sure that nobody changes they don't care if people change their mind. They just want to make sure that the country doesn't change its collective mind. I think what's interesting about this is this debate about we could change our mind, we could actually stay within the EU. Of course, those are all nice coulds for people like me who are arch Remainers. But the reality is that the people who voted Brexit, well, certainly many of those in the Tory party, are indifferent to many of the concerns that have been raised. The concerns now are about, our economy may be, screwed, as it were. Well, screwed is the right word. And that many of our industries may fall apart. They don't care. That isn't the problem. They're not interested in prosperity or how much money people have in their pocket or whether it's good or bad for business. They care whether they have full control over what they see as, the decisions of state. And so all these things about, it's not going very well. They don't give a damn. It can go horribly wrong. It can ruin the country. It can put people out of work. It can make people's lives miserable. But they will be happy because that's not what they're worried about. They're just worried about, can some judge in Europe override a rubbish decision in the UK? They'd rather have a rubbish decision from the UK than someone override it. That is all they care about.
The Conservative Party has today announced the plan to enshrine the time in law by announcing that that means Britain will be able to make its own laws again. But they have, you would think, undermined that argument by confirming that they are actually making a law in Britain, which is still in the EU, which not for the first time makes you wonder what we're actually doing here. Henry, is halting the process, though it is theoretically possible, as Lord Kerr points out, is it actually a realistic option?
I think one interesting angle to think about this from is the demographic one. So, we know that the vast majority of people who, the vast majority of young people voted to remain. The majority of older people voted to leave. And I think that as my generation, people in their 20s and 30s, begin to come into power politically and in other spheres as well.
What if you all turn into Eurosceptic cranks as you get older, though?
Well, be that as it may, if that happens, then this argument is moot. But if we don't, and I do think there's a chance that we might not, I think the interesting question is, will we be willing to accept the status quo that we've inherited, which, if Brexit does go ahead, would be one of, I think, as Andrew hinted at in his answer to the last question, one of probably a nation in decline, probably a nation with a very unfavourable deal with the EU, and a nation which has been defined by the results of a decision that we didn't make. I'm not sure if we will stand for that. And so even if Brexit is achieved by this deadline that's been set in 2019, even if Article 50 is fulfilled this time round, I know Lord Kerr said in his speech that it would be costly and difficult to re-enter the EU. I don't think... I think that might be a more likely end result in 30, 40, 50 years than us not going through with it this time round.
Oh, so there's only 30, 40, 50 years of rubbish that we have to put up with before we can potentially get some kind of correction.
Yeah, look on the bright side.
Kiara, there's been a lot of talk this week about a valedictory piece in the New York Times by the outgoing London bureau chief who described the United Kingdom kind of as an... I think actually, he may actually literally have used the phrase as a nation having some sort of nervous breakdown. As the token citizen of the non-UK EU at this table, is that how Britain seems to you at the moment?
Well, I think whenever I go back to Italy or I have conversations with Italians, most people seem under the impression that surely it was just a mistake and we'll find a way not to do it eventually. And I think one of the discussions that I have the most with them is to explain that the reason why so many people are so keen to go ahead, even if they are staunch Remainers, not that they're keen to go ahead, but they understand the necessity to go ahead, even if they are staunch Remainers, is the fact that there's also an issue of the nature of democracy at stake in certain sense. So I think that most people struggle to understand the very reasons behind it was done in the first place. And most people, I think, seem to agree or at least have caught on to the early news that was let out into Europe at quite early after the vote, that perhaps there was going to be a way that the MPs were going to be able to block the bill, or that there was going to be a hope for a second referendum. A lot of people still asking about the second referendum.
Andrew, there's opinion polls are still being taken about Brexit. There's general agreement that the process is other than seamless, and there's a lot of dissatisfaction with how it's being handled. But the actual numbers about the proposition, stay or go, are not shifting all that much. For any kind of handbrake turn to be executed by whoever is in charge at the time, what kind of numbers would polls need to be showing before any government was even confident enough to say, let's have another vote on the final deal?
Well, I don't think that the numbers in the polls would be enough, even if they showed a large number of people hoping now to remain. I think you'd have to see some representation of that in the way that the business community was acting. If, for example, one of the big car companies said, actually, we're going to open our new plant in the Czech Republic, we're not going to do it up in the north of England. If we saw a migration of jobs, a really meaningful migration of jobs from the city beginning to happen, then those kind of things would begin to throw up some questions. I think what's interesting is we already see that the numbers of people coming from Europe have fallen. The migrant work coming here has fallen off in every category. And I think that is going to undermine the UK in really interesting ways. In a way, what we need to see is Britain feel the pain of not being in the EU. And the problem is that we are still in the EU and we have all the benefits of being in the EU, and you will only feel them once you've left. And as Henry said, that's a horrible thing, but it's going to be the day after the party when you've got the hangover. That's the moment you're going to think, oh my God, I did something last night I regret.
Well, rather delightfully, of course, if Britain does leave the EU on March 29th, 2019, I think I'm right in saying the first working day will be April 1st. Let's look now at Vietnam, to where Donald Trump has finally got, despite those famously troublesome bone spurs of his. It is the latest stop on the US President's Five Nation Asian Tour. In Da Nang, Trump spoke at the APEC summit, as did his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping in an illustration of the world in which we now appear to be living. The General Secretary of the Communist Party of China spoke rousingly in favour of free global trade, while the leader of the free world advocated protectionism and self-interest. Kiara, I wanted to talk about the visuals of Trump's procession around Southeast Asia. He has been greeted with, I mean, obviously the US president gets a fairly lavish reception most places he goes, but they really have laid it on in Japan and China and South Korea. Have they figured out that the way to Trump's heart is through flattery?
I think that was quite obvious for a long time. And it is quite saddening to think that it's a similar attitude like to giving a child an ice cream in order to make him stop
shouting. They're probably also giving him ice creams.
No, they gave him beef burgers. And no, actually, a beef steak instead of raw fish, which he apparently really dislikes. I think that it's difficult, and again, I think throws up questions about the way that we understand position and role as opposed to single individuals, in the way that whether we can consider the option of not really offering any festive reception to a person like the President of the United States because we disagree with them. The UK has put, your Speaker of the House of the UK has put forward an argument saying that he shouldn't be allowed to speak in the UK. I don't know
well,
how
he
many
other... Not speak in the UK, but address the joint joint Houses of Parliament.
I mean, Cara, I do want to point out there is a wide spectrum of hospitality between kind of not hosting anyone at all and presenting them with a Donald and Shinzo make alliance even greater hat. And I think that there's room for manoeuvre there, which perhaps is something that other countries can explore. But it has been fascinating, hasn't it, to see that the level of pageantry which has been laid on in that part of the world for Donald Trump. And it's also fascinating to consider, like, what are they hearing about him? What do they think about him? Is this an accurate reflection of what people think about
I think it might be the thing Kiara was suggesting, that you just give him the shiny thing to make him happy and keep him quiet. I mean,
do you think it's purely strategic, then?
I don't know, Andrew. What do you think? My basic suspicion at this point is that everybody has realised by now that Trump basically is what he appeared to be when he was running, that this is not really somebody you can do any serious business with or need to take seriously, so best just to try and keep him calm until this all blows over.
Well, for fear this all conversation all goes one way, I think some of the things he said, so his comments in Vietnam about trade, about America first, you know, we only ever hear in the liberal press that top line, America first. But in fact, when you listen to the speech, he did say, you know, I, the same as you, believe that, you know, we go into these trade negotiations, we go into business believing that our country should be first, the priority. And what I will say to you is, you know, if we come to some agreement and we both play the same game, then I think we're going to get on nicely. But I think that in the past there have been trade decisions that have been bad for the US. Now, everyone kind of agrees that that's true. You know, there was you know, dumping of iron ore in the US. There were loopholes that were exploited. Now, if Obama had gone and said those things, if he had said, look, you know, I think there has been, in some fields, too much of a one-way street here, I want a correction, we'd have applauded him. So I think that he's not wrong in all the things he's saying about trade. And I think in Abe, I think Abe genuinely likes him and genuinely thinks he's a good thing potentially for America. What Xi Jinping thinks is harder to read. But again, it's interesting how he plays that, because I think there's very much good cop, bad cop. He often, within him, he plays both sides of the game. One point he's hammering China, and then the next minute he's like, look, it's not your fault that you exploited us, you know, we weren't prepared. And he probably leaves them a little bit unsure, and maybe in diplomacy that isn't always bad. So I'm no supporter of Trump, but I would imagine that after this Asia tour, on the whole, they will get back to DC thinking it went pretty well, actually.
Just to follow up the earlier chat there, though, Andrew, Donald Trump has not yet come to the United Kingdom. Should he? And how is that going to be best managed?
Well, I have huge sympathy with people who think that he shouldn't come and that he should be blocked. But actually, as a proponent of and a supporter of free speech and the belief that we do need to have a relationship with the US, I'm happy for him to come on the grounds that everybody is allowed to protest. I think he should be invited here, and then he should see it's one of the biggest political protests against his presence that he's ever seen. That is the only thing. He hates that. That is what would hurt him more than the fact that he never comes here and he never touches into it. And as we remember, going back, you know, we had Ceaușescu here as a guest, like having a good old kind of
honorary knight, in fact.
Yeah, having a nice afternoon with the Queen. Yeah, and at that time, he had political prisoners. He was overseeing a regime that meant thousands of children were starving to death in orphanages. But we didn't have any qualms about that. And for all of the, you know, the showmanship and the horrible things around Donald Trump, you know, he's not actually literally starving children at this point. But we did roll out the red carpet for him.
To go back to your point, Chiara, because it was one you raised there about what John Bercow, the Speaker of the House here, had said, that his words were he didn't think Donald Trump had earned the honour of speaking to both houses. And it's not automatically afforded to US presidents. Only Reagan, Clinton and Obama have been invited, all two-termers, I think it's fair to say. But even when it is an extraordinary creature like Donald Trump occupying that role, should you respect the office, if not necessarily the occupant of it?
I think what Andrew said earlier is definitely relevant. I think one of the arguments that was posed against the idea of perhaps coming just a few weeks after he had been elected, after he'd taken office rather, was that he hadn't had a chance to prove what his presidency would be like. I don't know if the element of time would be a very significant difference right now, because I don't think that people's opinions have shifted very much over the course of the last months. I mean, at the time, it was just after the Muslim ban, and it was after a few very, very significant things that had just happened. But I don't think that if honour is something that you have to earn in terms of what you have achieved over the past few months, I don't think things have changed very much.
And I would just jump in there. I would say that what's interesting is when you think of Macron had Trump and the whole kind of, you know, pageantry that follows him to Paris. He didn't come out of it badly. He came out of it super well. You know, he even kind of managed to hand wrestle old Trump and kind of come out the better of it. The imagery, you know, he put on pomp and circumstance for the man and for America. And it made France look amazing. It made him look young and vital. He was the more poised leader. Now, the fear coming here is that he would meet Theresa May. And that is that, you know, there is no arm wrestling there that comes out successful for the UK.
Just one very small point, which is that I think it is instructive to just acknowledge that John Bercow, you know, made the distinction. He doesn't oppose, and he admitted it's beyond his pay grade to oppose, a state visit to the UK. I think what he opposes is giving Trump the platform to address both chambers of parliament. And that would be a very different situation to the one that Andrew's
Yeah, but it gets into the same territory of, you know, universities saying we're not going to hear these people because we don't like them. Now, actually, he is the leader of the free world, like it or lump it. And maybe he should be there and the people who don't like it not be present. You know, an empty room is a better protest than actually not allowing him to come in the first place.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Andrew Tuck, Chiara Ramella and Henry Rhys Sheridan. Coming up next, should some vandalism be protected by law?
Visit our online shop where you can find items designed by our in-house team and collaborations with the brands that we love. Discover everything from luggage and clothes to stationery and back issues of the magazine, as well as our book series and popular travel guides. We deliver worldwide and offer high-quality customer service. And don't forget to let us know if you're a Monocle subscriber to enjoy your 10% discount. Go to monocle.com/shop and browse away. Or if you're in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, London, New York or Toronto, visit us at one of our shops and we'll take care of you personally. See you around.
Yeah, You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Andrew Tuck, Henry Rhys Sheridan and Chiara Ramella. Now, one might assume that artists who practice their art outside the law would tend towards the philosophical when their appropriated canvases get hosed off, painted over or demolished. One would not have met the group of New York graffitis to have won a legal action against a property developer who, in 2013, whitewashed a building in Queens, which they had daubed. A federal jury has decided that the graffiti was protected by the Visual Artists' Rights Act, raising the prospect of similar suits against anyone trying to keep their walls clean. Andrew, host of The Urbanist on Monocle 24, does this sound a bit daft? It sounds a bit daft.
I think there's when you look at the cases, there's some complexity that the owner of the building had invited the artist to make their work. He knew that he'd invited in people of a certain stature, and they've proved that their work is of certain stature.
But on the understanding that it would be temporary?
Well, no, I don't think that was ever kind of really kind of discussed in a kind of contractual basis.
Maybe he just thought it was self-evident.
And also, in this case, the judge now has the right to do whatever he wants. He's not bound by the decision of the jury. So it's even now likely that, you know, the building will be allowed to be painted. One of the glorious things about graffiti is it is there to be erased in a way. It's not there to be put up as a monument. It's not of that kind of artwork. And if every piece of kind of graffiti that had been protected in London since it had been put up would be a very different thing. Now, do you say that some of it is, have a different merit and is a thing of beauty and encapsulates a moment? Then maybe. I was in Aarhus in Denmark recently, and the woman who first made the Atomkraft Nine Dank, they've made an amazing mural to kind of celebrate her residency in the city. And I think that's part of the city's history and it should be protected. And everyone, you know, would be delighted to have a Banksy on their wall if they could make a few million quid out of it. But on the whole, I don't mind the fact that these things come a little bit and get erased. But then on the other side, just make things even more confusing, there's a lot of it I just hate. And a lot of it I think is just utter rubbish, and I'd much rather have, you know, I don't want it on my front door. And then when you go to places like, you know, well, Chiara's from Italy, but when you go to Milan and you take the train in or you go around the city, the level of just, you know, mindless tagging of buildings.
I had much the same thought in Bologna last month.
Yeah. It's Italy has a real problem with it, and it's like, it's hideous.
Chiara, are these graffitists being somewhat precious, or do the people who have scrawled, for example, all over those lovely red brick buildings in Bologna deserve the same protection?
No, I think this is an interesting question about how we recognise the value of art in general as well. This case is interesting because it sets a precedent, and because then it throws into question how we are going to decide whether these things are worth keeping or not, and where that line is drawn is quite difficult. I mean, there's all sorts of debates around what makes art in a very kind of codified context art or not, and something like this even throws more variance into the realm.
Henry, if you want your art to be permanent, isn't that something you should think of before you decide where you're going to paint it?
Well, one really interesting development earlier this year, I think, that happened in the world of graffiti and urban art in general, is that Berlin opened a museum of urban art and graffiti and invited some of the world's most famous graffiti artists to come and create work to be displayed in that museum, which I think really kind of shines a light on the complexity of the motivations of these people in this day and age. You know, I think I was reading an article about it earlier, and there was a famous graffiti artist, French guy, who was quoted as saying most of the people he knows wants to be accepted by the blue chip art community. They maybe want to make a little bit of money. I don't know if they're getting a bit older, but I'm not sure if the intention to create graffiti is necessarily paired with an acceptance of it being temporary now. It's an interesting one, though.
And there is a continuum here. There is the bit that starts at vandalism, and there's the bit that ends at street art. And in between, there's a kind of a murky area, which I presume ends up in court cases. But actually, there is a whole category which is just vandalism, and it's just like hideous and awful, and that I think we have to be careful we don't get too caught up with celebrating just mindless idiots kind of like scrawling rubbish across your front door.
Well, let's move along finally to another aesthetic contemplation, and you will all have handouts in front of you prepared earlier, because in an annual rebuke to the admonition about judging books by their covers, the Books Are My Bag Readers Awards have announced their shortlist of six for the year's best looking book. You have very small pictures of them here in front of you. The thing that occurred to me was that, is it weird, anybody, that book covers, book jackets, have never become anything like as big a deal, as venerated as record sleeves? There's a whole sort of industry of discussion and ranking and contextualizing and dissection of record sleeves, but there's almost...
But in part, is that because, you know, every generation remakes those covers? You know, so if you think of... You know, I was looking at some of the Penguin classics before we came on, and there's many of those books I remember reading when I was in my 20s, and then when I saw them again in the 30s, I had a different image on, and the 40s, you know, so they get remade again and again. Whether an LP or a CD is given a piece of cover art that remains with it throughout its entire journey.
But that's what I was wondering, why not do that with books? Why are books adaptable and mutable?
I think the Penguin classics have been pretty thoroughly fetishized, haven't they? Would you concede that that's an exception?
Yeah, that is an exception, and weirdly, it's the most utilitarian, you know, book jacket imaginable, you know, author title, basically.
That is really interesting. I can't think of a
It's like Shakespeare is remade for every generation. So George Orwell is made for every generation. Or, you know, I guess Evelyn Waugh is reinterpreted for every generation to try and bring new readers in. So they choose an image that they think will talk to that generation. Can I just say, of these six, I don't like any of them.
I don't like them.
I don't like them either.
Really, really horrible.
And anybody, Chiara, do you wish to make a case for any of these?
The one that I dislike the least is the Ravelius and Co., because it reminds me a little bit of a Joy Division cover. It's got that kind of gothic tombstone look, doesn't it?
It's a similar font, I think, as well.
Andrew, I've got a question for you. Correct me if I'm wrong, I think you're the only person around this table who has published a book that they've authored. How much of a say do you have over
quite a lot.
The cover?
Well,
really?
I did quite a lot. And when you
Why
say
do you think his face is on the front?
My face is only on the front of one of them. And when you say published a book, I have published three. All still available,
okay, I stand corrected.
In good stores. A fourth, hopefully, next year. I've made three albums as well, of course. But it did just occur to me that the conversations about what the albums were going to look like were much, much more involved and complicated than any discussion about what the books were going to look like, partly because we do have this double standard.
Is it because the experience of the album art is a more important component of the experience of that album?
Well, clearly
it is,
but I don't know why that should be the case, really.
Well, because there's a whole... There are many more pages between covers, aren't there?
Is it just because the album sleeve is the only place on a record where there's text, whereas obviously in a book there's pages of...
Well, it's the only visual component, isn't it?
I guess the
book is intrinsically visual throughout.
But does anyone have a view on what makes a good book cover? Does anyone have a favourite book cover?
Well, I don't know my favourite. I always used to envy the people who worked at Penguin when they were doing a lot of photographic covers. I thought that was great, and I also like covers that go into the art archive and pick amazing artworks. So I think oddly you don't have to be too inventive. I think often there is an image that exists that tells the story of a book as well.
I really like early and mid-20th century Faber editions, like the T.S. Eliot. Do you know what I mean? I don't understand what's between the covers. Let me just admit to that now, but I like looking at them.
I must say that Henry Reece Sheridan is quite a good name to have on a book jacket as well. I think you need to write a book because, you know...
That's a struggle, isn't it, Andrew? Thanks, though. I appreciate it.
Like Henry James and, obviously, Sheridan. You've got kind of all the names going on there.
Yeah, well, you know, I'll work towards it.
Chiara, do you have a vote for a favourite book jacket?
I've prepared so much.
Fantastic.
I've even brought in a picture of, and I think this is particularly representative. It's the book cover of Valerie and Her Week of Wonders. And I think it's particularly relevant because it's the first cover that I thought about when I thought I liked one, but I've never actually read the book.
Okay.
But did you buy the book?
I bought it, yes, of course. It's a surrealist novel, and I don't really like surrealist novels very much. So it just sits there on the bookshelf.
Andrew, will you attempt a description for this? Very briefly.
Yeah, it is a headless apparition wearing what I take to be sort of oldie-worldy attire, and there's lots of dots and It is quite nice, actually.
Sounds like one of Chiara's outfits.
Yeah, exactly. So Valerie and her Week of Wonders by Vitislav Nezval. And on that plug, that brings us to the end of today's show. Andrew Tuck, Henry Rhys Sheridan and Chiara Ramilla, thank you for joining us. The show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Chloe Carnesis. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next, followed by The Menu at 1900. And I'm back with more on the day's big stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Have a good weekend.